director of the large Strigiformes family, QV, also called by local people a Corrigan, Rutterkin, Rumpelstiltskin, Fidgeter or Mesmer. One thing can be said about him. He is dreadfully beastly. He is such a devil's spawn and scoundrel, such a bitch's tail, that we shall not write anything about his appearance or habits, since in sooth, I tell you, we shall not waste breath on the whoreson. Physiologus. Chapter 4. An odour that was a mixture of the smells of old wooden panelling, melting candles, and 10 kinds of perfume, hung in the columned hall of Monte Calvo Castle. 10 specially selected blends of scent, used by the 10 women, seated at a round oak table, in armchairs carved in the shape of sphinxes' heads. Fringilla Vigo regarded Triss Merigold, sitting opposite her, in a light blue dress, buttoned high up to the neck. Beside Triss, remaining in the shadows, sat Kira Metz. Her large, eye-catching earrings of many-faceted citrines sparkled every now and then with 1,000 reflections.
"Please continue, Miss Vigo," urged Philippa Eilhart. "We're in a hurry to learn the end of the story and to take urgent steps."
Philippa, exceptionally, wasn't wearing any jewellery apart from a large sardonyx cameo brooch pinned to her vermilion dress. Fringilla had already heard the rumour and knew whose present the cameo brooch had been and whose profile it depicted. Sheila de Tankerville, sitting beside Philippa, was all in black, diamonds twinkling subtly. Margarita Lozantila wore heavy gold without stones on claret-coloured satins, while Sabrina Glevisig had her favourite onyxes matching the colour of her eyes in her necklace, earrings and rings. Nearest to Fringilla sat the two elves, Francesca Finderbeer and Ida Emain Ap Siveni. The Daisy of the Valleys was, as usual, regal, though today neither her coiffure nor her crimson dress were extraordinarily splendid, and the red of her diadem and necklace was that of modest, though tasteful, garnets, not rubies. Ida Emain, meanwhile, was dressed in muslins and tulles in autumn tones, so delicate and gauzy that they swayed and undulated like anemones, even in the barely perceptible draughts triggered by the movement of the centrally heated air. As usual of late, Azireva Anahid's modest but distinguished elegance aroused admiration. The Nilfgaardian sorceress wore a single emerald cabochon in a gold setting on a gold chain, resting in the high decolletage of her close-fitting dark green dress. Her manicured fingernails, painted very dark green, gave the composition a flavour of truly magical extravagance.
"We are waiting, Miss Vigo," reminded Charlotte Tankerville. "Time's passing."
Fringilla cleared her throat.
"December came," she began her story. "Yule came, then the new year. The Witcher calmed down sufficiently to stop mentioning Ciri in every conversation. The expeditions against monsters that he regularly undertook seemed utterly to absorb him. Well, perhaps not quite utterly."
She paused. It seemed to her she could detect a flash of hatred in Triss Merigold's azure eyes, but it might just have been the gleam of flickering candle flame. Philippa snorted, playing with her brooch.
"Don't overdo the modesty, Miss Vigo. This is a closed circle. A circle of women who know what, apart from pleasure, sex can serve. We all use that tool when the need arises. Please, go on."
"Even if during the day he maintained the appearance of secretiveness, superiority and pride," continued Fringilla, "at night he was completely in my power. He told me everything. He paid homage to my femininity, which, considering his age, was extremely generous, I must admit. And then he fell asleep, in my arms, with his mouth on my bosom, searching for a surrogate for the maternal love he never experienced."
This time, she was certain, it wasn't the gleam of candlelight.
"Very well, I pray you envy me," she thought. "Envy me. There's plenty to envy." "He was," she repeated, "completely in my power."
"Come back to bed, Geralt. The sky is still bloody grey."
"I'm meeting someone. I have to ride to Pomerol.
I don't want you to write to Pomerol.
I'm meeting someone. I've given the word. The manager of the vineyard will be waiting for me by the gate.
This monster hunting of yours is stupid and pointless. What are you trying to prove by killing another monster from the caverns? Your masculinity?
I know better ways. Come on, back to bed. You aren't going to any Pomerol. At least not so quickly. This steward can wait. And anyway, what is a steward? I want to make love with you.
Forgive me. I don't have time. I'll give him a word.
I want to make love with you.
If you want to join me for breakfast, start getting dressed.
I don't think you love me, Geralt. Don't you love me anymore? Answer me.
Put on that grey and pearl dress, the one with the mink trimming. It suits you very much.
He was completely under my spell. He fulfilled my every wish,
repeated Fringilla.
He did everything I demanded of him. That's how it was.
And we believe you,
said Shayla de Tankerville, extremely dryly.
Please continue.
Fringilla coughed into her fist.
The problem was his troop, she went on. That strange assemblage he called a company. Cair Mawr Daifran Ap Cialach, who watched me and flushed with effort trying to remember me. But he couldn't recall, because when I stayed at Dun Daifra, his grandparents' family castle, he was 6 or 7. Milva, an apparently swashbuckling and haughty girl, and whom I happened to catch crying twice, hiding in a corner of the stable. Angoulême, a flighty whelp, and Regis Tertiev Godefroy, a character I was unable to fathom. That entire gang had an influence on him I couldn't eradicate.
Very well, very well, she thought. Don't raise your eyebrows so high. Don't sneer. Wait, that's not the end of the story yet. You're yet to hear of my triumph.
Every morning, she continued, the whole company would meet in the kitchen in the basement of Beauclair Palace. The royal chef was fond of them, God knows why. He always cooked something up for them, so ample and tasty that breakfast usually lasted 2, and occasionally even 3 hours. Geralt and I ate with them many times, which is how I know what absurd conversations they used to have.
Two hens, one black, the other speckled, were walking around the kitchen, stepping timidly on their clawed feet. Glancing at the company breaking their fast, the hens pecked crumbs from the floor. The company had gathered in the palace kitchen, as they did every morning. The royal chef was fond of them, God knows why, and always had something tasty for them. Today it was scrambled eggs, sour rye soup, stewed aubergine, rabbit forcemeat, goose breasts and sausage with beetroot, with a large circle of goat's cheese on the side. They all ate, briskly and in silence, apart from Angoulême, who was talking nonsense.
Anatoly, we should set up a brothel here. When we've done what we have to do, let's return and open a house of ill repute. I've looked around in town. There's everything here. There are 10 barber shops alone and 8 apothecaries, but there's only one knocking shop, and it's more like a seedy shithouse than a proper cat house, I tell you. There's no competition. We'll open a luxury bordello. We'll buy a big house with a garden. Angoulême, have mercy. Just for respectable punters. I'll be the madam. I tell you, we'll make a fortune and live like kings. Finally, they'll elect me councillor, and then I won't let you die for sure, because when they elect me, I'll elect you, and before you can say Jack Robinson, Angoulême, we've asked. There, eat some bread and forcemeat.
It was quiet for a while.
What are you hunting today, Geralt? Tough job.
Eyewitnesses gave conflicting descriptions. The witcher raised his head from his plate. So, it's either a Pruskiernik, i.e. a fairly hard job, or a Drelichon, i.e. a fairly hard job, or a Najempik, a fairly easy one. It might turn out the job's extremely easy, because they last saw the monster before Lammas last year. It might have bolted from Pomerol over the hills and far away.
I hope it has,
said Fringilla, gnawing at a goosebone. And how's Dandelion doing? The witcher suddenly asked. I haven't seen him for such a long time that I get all my information about him from lampoons sung in the town.
We aren't any better off,
smiled Regis with pursed lips. All we know is that our poet is on such intimate terms with Lady Duchess Anarietta that she's allowed him, even before witnesses, to use quite a familiar cognomen. He calls her Little Weasel.
That's very apt, Angoulême said with her mouth full. That Lady Duchess really does have a weaselly nose, not to mention her teeth.
No one's perfect.
Fringilla narrowed her eyes.
How very true.
The hens, the black and the speckled one, had become audacious enough to begin pecking at Milva's boots. The archer drove them away with a brisk kick and an oath. Geralt had been scrutinizing her for some time. Now he made up his mind.
Maria, he said gravely, almost harshly, I know our conversations can't be considered serious or our jokes sophisticated, but you don't have to pull such sour faces. What's the matter?
Something must be the matter, said Angoulême.
Geralt silenced her with a fierce look. Too late.
What do you know?
Milva stood up suddenly, almost knocking over her chair.
What do you know, eh? The devil take you. You can kiss my arse, all of you. Get it?
She grabbed her cup from the table, drained it, and smashed it on the floor without a second thought, and ran out, slamming the door.
Things are serious,
Angoulême began a moment later, but this time the vampire silenced her.
The matter is very serious, he confirmed. I hadn't expected such an extreme reaction from our archer. One usually reacts like that when one is jilted, not when one jilts another.
What the bloody hell are you talking about? Said Geralt, annoyed. Eh? Perhaps someone will finally explain what this is all about.
It's about Baron Amadis de Trastamara.
The tight-lipped hunter?
The very same. He proposed to Milva 3 days ago on a hunting trip. He'd been inviting her to go hunting for a month.
One hunt, Angoulême flashed her teeth impudently, lasted 2 days, with the night spent in his hunting lodge. Get it? I swear, shut up, girl.
Speak, Regis.
He formally and ceremoniously asked for her hand. Milva declined, it appears, in quite a harsh way. The Baron, though he looks level-headed, was upset by the rejection, sulked like a jilted stripling, and immediately left Beauclerc. And since then, Milva has been walking around downcast.
We've been here too long, muttered the Witcher. Too long.
Now who's talking? Said Caer, who had said nothing up until then.
Who's talking?
Forgive me.
The Witcher stood up.
We'll talk about it when I return. The steward of Pomerol Vineyard is waiting for me, and punctuality is part of the Witcher's code.
After Milva's abrupt exit and the Witcher's departure, the rest of the company ate in silence. The two hens, one black, the other speckled, walked around the kitchen, stepping timidly on their clawed feet.
I have a small problem, said Angoulême, raising her eyes towards Fringilla from over the plate she was wiping with a crust.
I understand, nodded the sorceress. It's nothing dreadful. When was your last period?
What do you mean?
Angoulême leapt to her feet, frightening the chickens.
It's nothing of the sort. It's something completely different.
Tell me.
Geralt wants to leave me here when he goes back on the road.
Oh?
He says, Angoulême snapped, that he can't put me at risk and similar rubbish, and I want to go with him.
Oh,
don't interrupt me, will ye? I want to go with him, with Geralt, because it's only when I'm with him I'm not afraid that one-eyed Volko will catch me. And here in Tucson,
Angoulême, Regis interrupted her, your words are in vain. Madame Vigo is listening but can't hear. Only one thing horrifies her, the Witcher leaving.
Oh?
Fringilla repeated, turning her head towards him and screwing up her eyes.
What are you hinting at, Mr. Terzi of Godefroy? The Witcher leaving? And when might that be, if one might ask?
Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, the vampire replied in a soft voice. But one day for certain. No offence intended.
I don't feel offended, responded Fringilla coldly. If you had me in mind, naturally.
Returning to you, Angoulême, I assure you that I shall discuss the matter of leaving Toussaint with Geralt. I guarantee you that the Witcher will hear my opinion on the subject.
Why, naturally, snorted Cahir. How did I know you'd say that, Madame Fringilla?
The sorceress looked long and hard at him.
The Witcher, she said finally, ought not to leave Toussaint. No one who wishes him well should encourage him to do that. Where will he have it so good as here? He is living in the lap of luxury. He has his monsters to hunt. He's earning a pretty penny from it. His friend and comrade is the favorite of the reigning duchess, and the duchess herself is also favorably disposed to him, mainly owing to the succubus that was haunting people's bedchambers. Yes, yes, gentlemen. Henrietta, like all the noble ladies of Toussaint, is inordinately well disposed towards the Witcher. For the succubus has suddenly stopped haunting. The ladies of Toussaint have thus clubbed together to pay him a special bonus, which they will deposit in the Witcher's account in the Chianfanelli's bank any day now, increasing the small fortune that the Witcher has already stored up there.
A pretty gesture from the ladies.
Regis didn't lower his gaze.
And a well-deserved bonus. It isn't easy to stop a succubus from haunting. You may believe me, Madame Fringilla.
I do. And while we're on the subject, one of the palace guards claims he saw it. At night, on the battlements of Caroberta's tower, in the company of another spectre, some kind of vampire. The two demons were taking a stroll, the guard swore, and they looked as though they were friends. Do you, perhaps, know anything about this, Mr. Regis? Are you able to explain it, sir?
No, I'm not, madam.
Regis didn't even bat an eyelid.
There are things in heaven and earth that even philosophers have never dreamed about.
Without doubt there are such things, said Fringilla, nodding her black hair. Regarding, nonetheless, whether the Witcher is preparing to depart, do you know anything else? For you see, he hasn't mentioned any such plan, and he usually tells me everything.
Of course he does, Cahir grunted. Fringilla ignored him.
Mr. Regis?
No,
the vampire said after a moment's silence.
No, Madame Fringilla, please worry not. The Witcher doesn't show us any greater affection or confidence than you. He doesn't whisper into our ears any secrets he would keep from you.
Well, then,
Fringilla was as composed as granite, do these revelations about departing come from?
Well, it's like our darling Angoulême's catchphrase, which brims with youthful charm.
The vampire didn't bat an eyelid this time either.
There comes a time when you've either got to shit or free up the shithouse. In other words, spare the other words.
Fringilla interrupted sharply.
Those charming ones will suffice.
Silence reigned for quite some time. The two hens, the black and the speckled one, walked around pecking whatever they could. Angoulême wiped her beetroot-stained nose with her sleeve. The vampire toyed pensively with a wooden peg from the sausage.
Thanks to me,
Fringilla broke the silence.
Geralt has come to know Ciri's lineage, the complexities and secrets of her genealogy, known only to a few. Thanks to me, he knows what he had no idea about a year ago. Thanks to me, he has information, and information is a weapon. Thanks to me and my magical protection, he is safe from enemy scanning, and thus also from assassins. Thanks to me and my magic, his knee doesn't hurt him now, and he can bend it. Around his neck is a medallion made by my magical art. Possibly not as good as his original Witcher one, but powerful anyway. Thanks to me, and only me, in the spring or summer, he will be able to face his enemies in combat, equipped with information, protected, fit, prepared, and armed. If anyone present here has done more for Geralt, given him more, may they step forward. I'd be happy to honor them.
No one said anything. The hens pecked Cahir's boots, but the young Nilfgaardian paid no attention. Verily, he said with a sneer, none of us has given Geralt more than you, my lady.
How did I know you'd say that?
That's not the point, Madame Fringilla, began the vampire.
The sorceress didn't let him finish.
What is the point, then?
She asked aggressively.
That he's with me? That we are joined by affection? That I don't want him to leave now? That I don't want a sense of guilt to destroy him? That same sense of guilt, that atonement which drove you all onto the road?
Regis said nothing. Caer didn't speak either. Angoulême watched, clearly not understanding very much.
If it is written in the Scrolls of Destiny, the sorceress said after a moment, that Geralt will win Ciri back, then it shall happen, irrespective of whether the Witcher goes into the mountains or whether he stays in Toussaint. Destiny catches up with people, and not the other way around. Do you understand that? Do you understand that, Lord Regis Tertsiev Godefroy?
Better than you think, Madame Vigo.
The vampire twiddled the wooden peg from the sausage.
But for me, please forgive me, destiny isn't a scroll written on by a great demiurge, nor the will of heaven, nor the inevitable verdict of some providence or other, but the result of many apparently unconnected facts, events, and occurrences. I would be inclined to agree with you that destiny catches up with people, and not just people. But the view that it can't be the other way around doesn't convince me, for such a view is facile fatalism, a paean praising torpor and indolence, a warm eiderdown and the beguiling warmth of a woman's loins. In short, life in a dream. And life, Madame Vigo, may be a dream, may also finish as a dream. But it's a dream that has to be dreamed actively, which is why, Madame Vigo, the road awaits us.
Suit yourselves!
Fringilla stood up, almost as suddenly as Milva a moment earlier.
As you wish. Blizzards, frost and destiny await you in the mountain passes, and the expiation you so sorely search for. Suit yourselves. But the Witcher shall stay here in Toussaint with me.
I think, the vampire said calmly, that you are wrong, Madame Vigo. The dream that the Witcher is dreaming, I humbly submit with respect, is an enchanting and beautiful one. But every dream, if dreamed too long, turns into a nightmare, and we awake from such dreams screaming.
The nine women sitting around the great round table in Monte Calvo Castle were looking fixedly at Fringilla Vigo. At Fringilla, who suddenly began to stammer.
Geralt left for the Pomerol Vineyard on the morning of the 8th of January, and returned at 8 in the evening, or 9 in the morning. I don't know, I'm not sure.
Organize your thoughts, Charlotte de Tankerville said gently. Please speak more coherently, Madame Vigo. And if part of the story discomfits you, you may simply pass over it.
The speckled hen, treading cautiously on its clawed feet, was walking around the kitchen. The smell of chicken broth was in the air. The door slammed open. Geralt rushed into the kitchen. He had a bruise and a purple and red scab on his windburned face.
Come on, company, get packed,
he announced, without necessary introductions. We're riding out, in an hour, and not a moment longer. I want to see you all on the hillock outside the town by that post, packed, in the saddle, ready for a long ride and a difficult one. That was enough. It was as though they had been waiting for this news for a long time, as though they'd been in readiness for a long time.
I'll be ready in a flash, yelled Milva, leaping up. I'll be ready in half an hour.
I will too.
Caer stood up, discarded a spoon, and looked closely at the Witcher. But I'd like to know what it is. A whim? A lover's tiff? Or are we really leaving?
We really are. Angoulême, why are you making faces?
Geralt, don't worry, I'm not leaving you. I've changed my mind. You need looking after my girl,
I can't let you out of my sight. To horse, I said. Get packed and fasten on your saddlebags. And singly, so as not to raise suspicion. Outside the town, by the post on the hillock. We'll meet there in an hour.
Without feel, Geralt, yelled Angoulême. At fucking last!
In the blink of an eye, all that was left in the kitchen were Geralt and the speckled hen, and the vampire, who went on calmly slurping chicken broth and dumplings.
Are you waiting for a special invitation? The witcher asked coldly. Why are you still sitting here, rather than loading up Dracul the mule and saying goodbye to the succubus?
Geralt, Regis said calmly, giving himself a second helping from the tureen. I need as long to say goodbye to the succubus as you do to your raven-haired beauty, assuming you have any intention of saying goodbye to her. And just between you and I, you can send the youngsters to get packed by shouting, hastening and making a fuss. I deserve something else, if only for reasons of age. A few words of explanation, please.
Regis, an explanation, Geralt.
The quicker you begin, the better. Yesterday morning, in accordance with your agreement, you met the steward of Pomerol Vineyard at the gate.
Alcides Firabras, the black-bearded steward of the Pomerol Vineyard he'd met in the pheasantry on Yule Eve, was waiting for the witcher at the gate with a mule, and he, in turn, was dressed and equipped as though planning to journey far, far away to the ends of the earth, beyond the Solviga Gate and the Elskadeg Pass.
"It's close, but as a matter of fact, it isn't," he responded to Geralt's sour remark. "You are, sire, a visitor from the wide world. Our little Tucson may seem a backwater to you. You think you can toss a hat from one border to the other and a dry one to boot. Well, you're mistaken. It's quite a long way to Pomerol Vineyard, which is where we're headed, and if we arrive by noon, it'll be a success." "So it's a mistake," the witcher said dryly, "for us to be setting off so tardily."
"Well, maybe it is." Alcides Firabras glowered at him and blew into his whiskers.
"But I knew not that you were the kind who was inclined to start at daybreak. For that's rare among grand lords." "I'm not a grand lord. Let's be off, steward, sir. Let's not waste time on idle chatter."
"You took the words right out of my mouth." They took a shortcut through the town. At first, Geralt wanted to protest, afraid of getting stuck in the familiar crowded back streets. But steward Firabras, it turned out, knew better both the town and the times when the streets wouldn't be crowded. They rode quickly and without difficulty. They entered the town square and passed the scaffold, and the gallows displaying a hanged man.
"A perilous thing," the steward nodded, "to make rhymes and sing airs, particularly in public."
"Judgments are harsh here," said Geralt, realizing what it was about. "Elsewhere you're pilloried at most for a lampoon."
"Depends who the lampoon's about," commented Alcides Firabras soberly, "and on the rhymes. Our Lady Duchess is good and endearing, but when she's irritated..."
"You can't stifle a song, as a friend of mine says."
"Not a song, but a singer you can, sir."
They crossed the town and left through the Cooper's Gate, straight into the Valley of the Blessure, whose rapids were briskly splashing and foaming. The snow in the fields was only in furrows and hollows, but it was quite cold. They were passed by a detachment of knights, heading, no doubt, towards the Pass of Cervantes, to the border watchtower of Vedette. Suddenly, all they could see were colourful griffins, lions, hearts, lilies, stars, crosses, chevrons, and other heraldic trifles, painted on shields and embroidered on cloaks and caparisons. Hooves drummed, pennants flapped, and a song resounded about the fortunes of a knight and his beloved, who married another instead of waiting for him. Geralt followed the detachment with his eyes. The sight of the knight's errand reminded him of Reynard de Boisfrene, who'd just returned from service and was recuperating in the arms of his townswoman, whose husband, a merchant, didn't return morning or night, probably having been held up somewhere on his journey by swollen rivers, forests full of beasts, and other turmoil of the elements. The witcher wouldn't have dreamed of tearing Reynar away from his lover's embrace, but sincerely regretted not postponing the contract with Pomerol Vineyard to a later date. He'd grown fond of the knight and missed his company.
"Let's ride, Master Witcher."
"Let us ride, Master Firabras."
They rode upstream along the highway. The Blessure wound and meandered, but there was an abundance of small bridges, so they didn't have to go out of their way. Steam belched from the nostrils of Roach and the mule.
"What do you think, Mr. Firbrass? Will the winter last long?"
"There were frosts at Solwyn, and the saying goes, when at Solwyn there's ice, dress warm and nice."
"I see. And your vines? Won't the winter damage them?"
"It's been colder." They rode on in silence.
"Look there," said Firbrass, pointing. "There in the valley lies the village of Foxholes. Pots grew in the field there. Wonder of wonders."
"I beg your pardon?"
"Pots. They grow in the bosom of the earth, just like that. A pure trick of nature, without any human help at all. Like spuds or turnips grow elsewhere. In foxholes, pots grow, of all shapes and kinds."
"Indeed.
As I live and breathe."
"For which reason Foxholes has an agreement with the village of Dudno in Mecht, because there, so the stories go, the earth bursts forth potlids." "Of all shapes and kinds."
"Precisely, Master Witcher."
They rode on in silence. The Blessure sparkled and foamed on the rocks.
"And look over yonder, Master Witcher, the ruins of the ancient borough of Duntina. That borough was the witness to dreadful scenes, if one is to believe the stories. Valgerius, who they called the Cuckold, killed his faithless wife, her lover, her mother, her sister and her brother, cruelly and bloodily, and then sat down and cried. No one knows why."
"I've heard about that."
"Have you been here before?"
"No."
"Ah, meaning the story has travelled widely."
"Precisely, Master Steward."
"And that slender tower, beyond that borough over there?" The Witcher pointed.
"What is it?"
"Over there? That's a temple."
"To which godhead?"
"Who'd remember that?"
"Very true. Who would?"
Around noon, they saw the vineyard, hillsides gently falling towards the Blessure, bristling with evenly pruned vines, now misshapen and woefully leafless. At the top of the highest hill, lashed by the wind, were the soaring towers, squat keep, and barbican of Pomerol Castle. Geralt was interested to see that the road leading to the castle was well used, no less furrowed by hooves and wheel rims than the main highway. It was evident that people often turned off the highway towards Pomerol Castle. He stopped his questions until he noticed, at the foot of the castle, a dozen or so wagons with horses and covered in tarpaulins, sturdy and well-made vehicles used for transporting goods long distances.
"Merchants," explained the steward when asked. "Wine merchants."
"Merchants?"
Geralt was surprised.
"How's that?
I thought the mountain passes were covered in snow and Toussaint cut off from the world. How could the merchants get here?"
"There are no bad roads for a merchant," said Steward Firebrass gravely. "At least not for those who treat their trade seriously. They observe the principle, Master Witcher, that since the end is justified, the means must be found."
"Indeed," Geralt said slowly. "An apposite principle, worthy of imitation, in any situation."
"Without doubt. But in truth, some of the traders have been stuck here since autumn, unable to leave. But they don't lose heart. They say, why, who cares? In the spring of the year, we'll be here first, before the competition shows up. With them, they call it positive thinking."
"It would be hard to fault that principle either," nodded Geralt.
"One thing still interests me, Master Steward. Why do the merchants stay here in the middle of nowhere and not in Beauclair? Isn't the Duchess keen on putting them up? Perhaps she disdains merchants."
"Not at all," answered Firbrass. "The Lady Duchess always invites them, while they graciously decline and stay among the vineyards."
"Why?"
"Beauclair, they say, is naught but feasts, balls, junkets, boozing and armour. A fellow, they say, only grows idle and stupid and wastes time instead of thinking about trade. And one should think about what's really important, about the goal guiding us, without let-up. Not distract your thinking on mere bagatelles. Then, and only then, is the intended goal achieved."
"Indeed, Mr. Firabrath," the Witcher said slowly. "I'm content with our shared journey. I've gained a great deal from our conversations. Truly, a great deal."
Contrary to the Witcher's expectations, they didn't ride to Pomerol Castle, but a little further, to a prominence beyond the valley, where another castle rose, somewhat smaller and much more neglected. The castle was called Tsubaran. Geralt was thrilled at the prospect of the upcoming work. Tsubaran, dark and toothed with crumbling crenellations, looked the epitome of an enchanted ruin, and was no doubt teeming with witchcraft, marvels and monsters. Inside, in the courtyard, instead of marvels and monsters, he saw around a dozen people preoccupied with tasks as enchanted as rolling barrels, planing planks and nailing them together. It smelled of fresh timber, fresh lime, stale cat, sour wine and pea soup. The pea soup was served out soon after. Made hungry by the journey, the wind and the cold, they ate briskly and in silence. They were accompanied by Steward Firabras's subordinate, introduced to Geralt as Shimon Gilka. They were served by two fair-haired women with plaits 2 ells long. They both sent the Witcher such suggestive glances, he decided to hasten to his work. Shimon Gilka hadn't seen the monster. He only knew of its appearance second-hand.
"It was as black as pitch, but when it crawled across the wall, the bricks could be seen through it. Like jelly it was, see, Master Witcher, or some sort of snot, if you'll excuse me. And it had long, thin limbs and a great number of them, 8 or even more. And Yontek stood and watched until at last he had a brainwave and shouted out loud, 'Die! Perish!' And then, through an exorcism, 'Croak, you bastard, by God!' Then the beastie, hop, 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 hopped away, and that's all we saw of it. Bolted into the cave mouth. Then the lad said, 'If there's a monster, give us a bonus for toiling in dangerous conditions, and if you don't, we'll complain to the guild.' And I says, 'Your guild can kiss my—'"
"When was the monster first seen?" Geralt interrupted.
"About 3 days since, bit before Yule."
"You said?" The Witcher looked at the steward. "Before Lammas."
Alcides Firabras blushed in the places not covered by his beard. Gilka snorted.
"Aye, aye, Master Steward. If you want a steward, you should come here more often and not just polish a chair with your arse in your office in Beauclair. That's what I think." "I'm not interested in what you'll think," interrupted Firabras. "We're talking about the monster." "But I've already said it, everything what happened."
"Weren't there any victims? Was no one attacked?"
"No. But last year, a farman disappeared without trace. Some say a monster dragged him into the chasm and finished him off. Others, meanwhile, say it weren't no monster, but that the farman made a cowardly escape off his own bat because of debts and alley money and maintenance. Because he, mark you, played the bones hard, and on top of that was shafting the miller's daughter. And that miller's daughter rushed to the courts, and the courts ordered the farman to pay maintenance. Did the monster attack anyone else?"
Geralt unceremoniously interrupted his discourse.
"Did anyone else see it?"
"No."
One of the serving women, pouring Geralt more of the local wine, brushed his ear with her breast, then winked encouragingly.
"Let's go," said Geralt quickly. "No point idling time away talking. Take me to these cellars."
Fringilla's amulet, unfortunately, didn't live up to the hopes pinned on it. Geralt didn't believe for a moment that the polished chrysoprase mounted in silver would replace his witcher's wolf medallion. In any case, Fringilla hadn't given any such promises. She had assured him, however, with great conviction, that after melding with the psyche of the wearer, the amulet was capable of various things, including warning of danger. Nonetheless, either Fringilla's spells hadn't worked, or Geralt and the amulet differed in the matter of what constituted danger. The chrysoprase perceptibly twitched when, as they walked to the cellars, they crossed the path of a large ginger cat sauntering across the courtyard with its tail in the air. Indeed, the cat must have received some kind of signal, for it fled, meowing dreadfully. When, though, the Witcher went down into the cellars, it kept vibrating annoyingly, but in dry, well-ordered and clean vaults, where the only danger was the wine in huge barrels.
Someone who had lost their self-control and was lying with their mouth open under the spigot would be in danger of serious overdrinking. And nothing else. The medallion didn't twitch, however, when Geralt abandoned the service part of the cellars and descended down a series of steps and drifts. The Witcher had worked out long before that there were ancient mines under most of the vineyards in Toussaint. When the vines had been planted and started to bear fruit and generate better profits, exploitation of the mines must have ceased, and the mines abandoned, their corridors and galleries partly modified into wine cellars and stores. Pomerol and Souberan castles stood over a disused slate mine. It was riddled with drifts and holes, and a moment's inattention would have been enough for one to end up at the bottom of one of them with a compound fracture. Some of the holes were covered by rotten planks covered with slate powder, and thus hardly differed from the floor. An incautious step onto something like that would have been dangerous, so the medallion ought to have given him a warning. It didn't. It also didn't give a warning when a vague grey shape sprang out of a heap of slate waste about 10 paces in front of Geralt, scratched the mine floor with its claws, pranced, howled piercingly, then uttered a squeal and a snicker before tearing off down the corridor and ducking into one of the niches gaping in the wall. The Witcher swore. The magical trinket reacted to ginger cats, but not to gremlins. He'd have to talk to Fringilla about that, he thought, as he approached the opening into which the creature had vanished. The amulet twitched powerfully. About time, he thought. But right away, he pondered matters more deeply. The medallion couldn't have been that stupid after all. The standard favourite tactic of the gremlin was to flee and then slash its pursuer from an ambush with a surprise blow of its sickle-sharp talons. A gremlin might be waiting there in the darkness, and the medallion had signalled it. He waited a long time, holding his breath, intently focusing his hearing. The amulet lay placid and inert on his chest. A musty, disagreeable stench drifted from the hole. It was deadly silent. And no gremlin could have endured being quiet for so long. Without a second thought, he entered the hole on hands and knees, scraping his back against the jagged rock. He didn't get far. Something rustled and cracked. The floor gave way, and the Witcher tumbled downwards, along with a few hundredweight of sand and stones. Fortunately, it didn't last long, and there wasn't a bottomless chasm under him, but an ordinary corridor. He flew like shit off his shovel and smashed with a crunch at the foot of a pile of rotten wood. He shook the dirt from his hair and spat sand, swearing very coarsely. The amulet was twitching ceaselessly, fluttering on his chest like a sparrow inside his jacket. The Witcher stopped just short of tearing it off and flinging it away. First of all, Fringilla would have been livid. Second of all, the chrysoprase was supposed to have other magical abilities. Geralt hoped they would be less unreliable. When he tried to stand up, he laid a hand on a rounded skull and realized that what he was lying on wasn't wood at all. He stood up and quickly inspected the pile of bones. They belonged to people. At the moment of their deaths, they had all been manacled and were most probably naked. The bones were crushed with bite marks. The victims might not have been alive when they were being bitten, but he couldn't be certain. He was led out of the drift by a long corridor, which headed onwards as straight as a die. The slate wall had been worked to a smooth finish. It no longer looked like a mine. He suddenly emerged into an immense cavern whose ceiling vanished into the darkness. In the centre of the cavern was a huge black bottomless hole, over which was suspended a dangerously fragile-looking stone bridge. The jingle of water dripping from the walls echoed. Coldness and unidentifiable stenches drifted up from the chasm. The amulet hung motionless. Geralt set foot on the bridge, intent and focused, trying hard to stay well away from the crumbling balustrade. There was another corridor on the far side of the bridge. He noticed rusted cressets in the smoothly carved walls. There were also niches, some of which contained small sandstone figures, but the ceaseless dripping of water had melted and eroded them into amorphous lumps. There were also tiles bearing reliefs set into the walls. The tiles were made of a more durable material, so the reliefs were still recognisable. Geralt made out a woman with crescent horns, a tower, a swallow, a wild boar, a dolphin, and a unicorn. He heard a voice. He stopped, holding his breath. The amulet twitched. No, it wasn't an illusion. It wasn't the murmur of shifting slate or the echo of dripping water. It was a human voice. Geralt shut his eyes and looked hard, searching for the source. The voice, the Witcher could have sworn, was coming from another niche, from behind another small figure, also eroded, but not enough to remove its shapely female curves. This time, the medallion did its job. It flashed, and Geralt suddenly saw a reflection of metal in the wall. He grasped the eroded woman in a powerful embrace and twisted hard. There was a grating, and the entire niche revolved on steel hinges, revealing a spiral staircase leading upwards. The voice again sounded from the top of the stairs. Geralt didn't think twice. At the top, he found a door that opened smoothly and without any grating. Beyond the door was a tiny vaulted room. Four enormous brass pipes, with their ends flared like trumpets, protruded from the wall. A chair stood in the middle, between the trumpet-like openings, and on the chair sat a skeleton. On its pate, it had the remains of a beretta, slumped down beyond its teeth. It was wearing the rags of fine garments. Around its neck was a golden chain, and on its feet, curled-toed Cordovan slippers, much gnawed by rats. The sound of a sneeze erupted from one of the horns, so loud and unexpected that the Witcher started. Then someone blew their nose, and the sound, intensified by the brass tube, was simply unbearable.
"Bless you," the pipe sounded. "Why, how your nose is running, Skellen?"
Geralt shoved the skeleton off the chair, not forgetting to remove and pocket the golden chain. Then he sat down at the surveillance post, at the end of the horn. One of the men being eavesdropped on had a deep, rumbling bass voice. When he spoke, the brass tube vibrated.
"Why, how your nose is running, Skellen. Where did you catch such a chill, and when?"
"Not worth mentioning," answered the man with the runny nose. "I caught the damned illness and now it won't subside. As soon as it lets up, it returns. Even magic doesn't help."
"Perhaps you ought to change your sorcerer," came another voice, grating like a rusty old hinge. "For at the moment, that Vilgefortz can't boast of much success, can he?"
"I'd say leave it,"
interjected someone speaking with characteristic, long, drawn-out syllables.
"That wasn't why we organized this meeting here in Tucson, at the world's end."
"At the end of the bloody world."
"This world's end," said the man with a cold, "is the only country I know that doesn't possess its own security service, the only call of the Empire that isn't crawling with Vatia de Rido's agents. They regard this endlessly merry and fuddled duchy as ridiculous, and no one takes it seriously." "Little countries like this," said the one who stretched out his syllables, "have always been a paradise for spies and favorite locations for rendezvous. So they also attract counterintelligence and narcs, diverse professional snoopers and eavesdroppers. Perhaps it was like that long ago, but not during the distaff governments that have prevailed in Tucson for almost 100 years. I repeat, we are safe here. No one will track us down or eavesdrop on us. We can, in the guise of merchants, calmly discuss matters so vital to your ducal majesties. So vital to your private fortunes and estates."
"I despise self-interest. It's as simple as that," said the one with the grating voice, annoyed. "And I'm not here for self-interest. I'm concerned only with the good of the Empire. And the good of the Empire, gentlemen, is a strong dynasty. It will be detrimental and most evil for the Empire of some mongrel, rotten fruit of bad blood and spawn of the corporally and morally sick northern kinglets, ascends to the throne. No, gentlemen. I, Devet of the Devets, shall not look impassively by the great sun at something like this.
particularly since my daughter had almost been promised.
Your daughter, the vet, roared the thundering bass. What am I to say? I, who supported that pup Emir in the fight against the usurper. Indeed, the cadets set off from my residence to storm the palace. Afterwards, the little sneak looked benignly at my Aylan, smiled, paid her compliments while he was squeezing her titties behind the curtain, I happen to know. And now what? A fresh empress? Such an affront, such an outrage. The emperor of the Eternal Empire, who prefers a stray from Sintra to the daughters of ancient houses. What? He's on the throne by my grace, and he dares insult my Aylan. No, I will not abide that.
Nor I, shouted another voice, high and gushing. He also maligned me. He discarded my wife for that Sintran stray.
As luck would have it, said the man who drawled his syllables, the stray has been dispatched to the next world. So it would appear from Lord Skellen's account.
I listened to that account attentively, said the grating-voiced man, and I've come to the conclusion that nothing is certain apart from that the stray vanished. If it has vanished, it may reappear once more. It has vanished and reappeared several times since last year. Indeed, Lord Skellen, you have disappointed us greatly. It's as simple as that. You and that sorcerer, Vilgefortz.
This is not the time, Joachim. Not the time to accuse and blame each other, driving a wedge into our unity. We must be a strong, unified force, and a decisive one. For it's not important if the Sintran is alive or not. An emperor who has once abused the ancient families with impunity will do it again. The Sintran is no more? Then he's liable in a few months to present us with an empress from Zerikania or Zangvibar. No, by the great sun, we shall not allow it.
We shall not allow it. It's as simple as that. Well said, Ardal. He has dashed the hopes of the Emrys family. Every moment Emir is on the throne, he damages the empire. Simple as that. And there is someone to put on the throne. Young Voris.
A loud sneeze, and then the sound of someone blowing their nose boomed out.
A constitutional monarchy, said the sneezer. It's high time for a constitutional monarchy, for a progressive political system, and afterwards democracy, the government of the people.
Imperator Voris, repeated the deep voice with emphasis. Imperator Voris, Stefan Skellen, who will be married to my Aylan or one of Joachim's daughters. And then I, as the Grand Chancellor of the Crown, and De Wet as the Marshal of Internal Affairs. Unless, as an advocate of some hoi polloi, you declare your resignation from the title and the position. What?
Let's leave aside historical processes, said the one with the cold in a conciliatory tone. Nothing can stop them anyhow. But for today, Your Grace, Grand Chancellor Abdai, if I have any reservations about Prince Voris, it's chiefly because he is a man of iron character, proud and unyielding, whom it is difficult to sway.
If one may say something, said the drawling voice, Prince Voris has a son, a little Movran. He is a much better candidate. Firstly, he has a more compelling right to the throne, both on the spear and the distaff side. Secondly, he's a child, on whose behalf a council of regents shall govern, which means us.
Foolishness! We shall cope with his father, too. We shall find a way.
We could plant my wife on him, suggested the gushing one.
Be silent, Lord Bruyne. Now is not the time.
Gentlemen, it behoves us to debate something else. It's as simple as that. For I would like to observe that Emir Var Emrys still reigns.
I'll say, agreed the man with the cold, trumpeting into a handkerchief. He lives and reigns as well in body and in mind. The second in particular cannot be questioned after he expelled from Nilfgaard both your graces and your armies, which may have been loyal to you. How do you plan to stage a coup, Duke Ardal, when at any moment you may have to go into battle at the head of the East Army Group? And by now, Duke Joachim should probably also be with his army and the Verden Special Operations Group.
Give the acerbity a miss, Stefan Skellen, and don't make faces that only you think make you look like your new paymaster, the sorcerer Vilgefortz. And know this, tawny owl, Since Emir suspects something, it is you and the Vilgefortz who shoulder the blame. Admit it, you'd like to capture the Sintron and trade her to gain favor with Emir, wouldn't you? Now that the girl is dead, there's nothing to trade with, is there? Emir will tear you apart with horses, simple as that. You must accept it with humility, you and the sorcerer you've allied with against us.
We must all accept it, Joachim, interjected the base. It's time to face facts. We aren't at all in a better position than Skellen. The circumstances have put us all in the same boat.
But it was Thorniarl who put us in that boat. We were supposed to act in secret, and now what? Emir knows everything. That Ederido's agents are hunting Thorniarl throughout the Empire, and we've been sent to war to get rid of ourselves, quite simply.
I'd be pleased about that, said the drawling one. I'd take advantage of it. Everyone has had enough of this current war, I can assure you, gentlemen. The army, the common folk, and above all merchants and entrepreneurs. News of a cessation of hostilities will be greeted throughout the Empire with great joy, irrespective of the result. And you, gentlemen, as commanders of the armies, have an influence on the result of the war permanently within arm's reach, so to speak, don't you? What could be easier than to don a laurel wreath in the event of the victory that ends the war? Or, in the event of defeat, to step forward as men of the moment, intercessors of the negotiations that'll put an end to the bloodshed?
True, said the one with the grating voice a moment later. By the great sun, it's true. You talk sense, Lord Leuvarden.
By sending you to the front, said the base, Emir put a noose around his own neck.
Emir is still alive, Your Grace, said the gushing one. He's alive and well. Let's not sell the bear's skin before catching the bear.
No, said the base. First, let's kill the bear.
There was a long silence. Assassination, dead. Death.
Death.
Death. Death. It's the only solution. As long as he's alive, Emir has supporters. When he dies, everyone will support us. The aristocracy will be on our side, for we are the aristocracy, and the aristocracy's strength is in its solidarity. A significant part of the army will be with us, particularly the part of the officer corps that remembers Emir's purges after the defeat at Sodden. And the people will be on our side, because the people are ignorant, stupid, and easily manipulated, finished Skellen, blowing his nose. It's enough to shout hurrah, make a speech from the steps of the Senate, open the prisons and lower taxes. You are absolutely right, Count, said the one who extended his syllables. Now I know why you clamor so for democracy.
I warn you, gentlemen, grated the one called Joachim, that it won't go off without a hitch. Our plan depends on Emir dying, and we can't close our eyes to the fact that Emir has many henchmen, has a corps of internal troops, and a fanatical guard. It won't be easy to hack our way through the Impera Brigade, and they, let's not delude ourselves, will fight to the last man.
And here, declared Skellen, Vilgefortz could offer us his help. We would have to besiege the palace or fight our way through the Impera. The issue will be solved by one assassin with magical protection, as it was in Tritgor just before the rebellion of the mages on Thanedd.
King Radovid of Redania.
That's right.
Does Vilgefortz have such an assassin?
He does. In order to prove our reliability, gentlemen, I'll tell you who it is. The sorceress Yennefer, who we're holding in prison.
In prison? I heard that Yennefer was Vilgefortz's accomplice.
She's his prisoner. She will carry out the assassination like a golem, bewitched, hypnotized, and programmed, and then commit suicide.
A bewitched hag doesn't especially suit me, said the one who drew out his syllables,
and his reluctance made him draw them out even more.
Better would be a hero, an ardent idealist, an avenger. An avenger, Skellen interrupted. That fits perfectly here, Lord Loivarden. Yennefer will be avenging the harm caused her by the tyrant. Emir tormented and caused the death of her ward, an innocent.